Tottenham story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfil those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
He's going to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh!
I'm loving big engines. Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Well, greetings all. After a suitable time to recover from Saturday's mauling at Newcastle, we are back to try and make sense of what went wrong on the road again and whether it's going to keep on happening with so many tough fixtures on the horizon. Plus, was supporting Aston Villa at Arsenal on Sunday the right thing to do? And Spurs are going to Wembley. Are your knees going trembly following the Tottenham women's 2-1 victory over Leicester in the FA Cup semi-final? It takes them through to a showdown with Manchester United. I'm Marcus Buckland alongside Dan Kilpatrick of The Standard and Tom Allnutt of The Times. Boys, let's just cut to the chase. Dan, who's to blame for what went so spectacularly wrong at Newcastle?
Hi, Marcus. Well, first thing to say, I wasn't at St James's Park, luckily. A good one for me to miss again. I also miss Fulham, as I feel like my colleague Dom Smith has a lot to answer for, who's been covering these games in my absence. I'm going to say largely the same stuff I've been saying, which I know will probably frustrate some fans, might frustrate you. I think it was obviously a really bad day for Spurs, judging from the highlights and reaction and everything that I've picked up on. Since Saturday, it was probably the worst performance of the season. I listened on the radio at the time and it certainly sounded like one of the worst performances of the season. I still think the discussion we had after the Fulham game, where Tom spoke very well about the need for Ange to stick to his principles but perhaps make some tweaks, I think that still stands. I still think the bigger picture is fine. I think what Ange said about growth being painful makes a lot of sense and is spot on, really. So I'm not unduly concerned, but I think, all Spurs problems kind of came to a head, didn't they, at St James's Park? You know, the lack of cover for the back line, the high-risk approach, the toothlessness in attack, the struggles to hold up the ball. I mean, there's a lot of issues there. They've got 2 weeks now to work on them before the Arsenal game. Obviously, it's imperative that Spurs massively improve for that one. Arguably the biggest fixture of the season. You know, a fabulous chance now to kind of completely derail Arsenal's title push. I actually think Spurs will be better in those big games against Arsenal, Manchester City and Liverpool. I mean, I know that's not hard, but I think it will suit them more. But yeah, certainly a grim performance. I'm not really going to get into blame or not, but I think a lot to put right before their next play.
And Tom, the thing that worries me is that it's not a one-off. As Dan just mentioned, the Fulham game was a very similar story. And to hear some people afterwards, I think rightly saying that the attitude of some of the players just looked wrong. I mean, I appreciate that you can have an off day collectively. And Son, for example, he had a shocker. That's why he went off early. And that can happen. But for a team to perform that woefully for the second time in three away games has alarm bells ringing for me. And I just wonder what Ange might now do about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tottenham are a really high-wire team. And there are two or three teams like this in the Premier League. Liverpool is sort of one of them, even though they're slightly more reliable than Spurs. Brighton, even Fulham, to be honest. The kind of side that really play on the edge in matches all the time. And I think as a result, it's not that surprising that they have these games where they basically get outplayed, hammered, thrashed, you know, and it's kind of a surprise for everyone. And we've seen this obviously against Fulham, against Brighton as well. And then this game, I think, are probably the three that really stand out. And I don't know if it's, I guess you can look at it either way. You can either look at it that this is kind of teething problems in the first season kind of syndrome under Ange, that it's not quite all come together yet, or you can think that this is kind of symptomatic of the kind of Ange way of playing, that it's always going to be like this. I think the defence is a big problem for Tottenham at the moment. And I'm slightly interested, slightly confused really about why it's such a big weakness for Spurs when you think that actually, if you look at the team, their back five in terms of the ability and talent they have there is probably one of the strongest areas of the team. You know, I mean, if we think about what the team is going to look like next season, there are going to be tweaks to pretty much every area, probably apart from the back five. I mean, the team that's going to start the first game of next season is going to be the same, right? Udogi, Poro, Van de Ven, Romero and Beccaria. We all think all five of those are excellent players in their own right. And yet Spurs' defence is a huge weakness for them. And when you compare them to the other, to the big three at the moment, who are streets ahead of everyone else, this is an area of the team where Spurs just aren't matching up. And if it's not the kind of individual ability of those five, then what is it? Why are Spurs basically so easy to score against, to create chances against? Because the problem that Tottenham have is that they have to score two or three goals to win every game. They have to work so hard and play so well up front to win games. They're constantly chasing, constantly having to pull themselves back. They can't just kind of win these easy 1-2-0 professional victories that, to be honest, you need to be able to do to get into that kind of title race bracket. Tottenham are having to play these harum-scarum matches every single week. And it's not sustainable. And it's not surprising to me that they have these matches where a team that plays on the edge, those margins go against them.
Haven't you answered your own question there, though, Tom? I mean, like, as we know, defending is not just down to the four defenders and the goalkeeper. You know, defending is all 11 players. You know, it's a team thing. And I think the back five on paper, as you said, are all top players and they're going to start next season in the same position, really. Whereas I think the problem I've got with Ange at the moment is not so much about the approach. You know, I don't buy into this thing. He needs to be pragmatic. He needs to change his approach. I think personnel, though, is a bit of a problem. I mean, I don't think Bissouma at six is providing nearly enough protection in front of the back four. That's clearly an issue. He hasn't really passed the eye test for me since October, pretty much, even though I know Ange has been saying he's had some good performances since then. And I think in the front three, where the defending arguably starts or finishes, depending on how you look at it, you know, there's a real problem with kind of holding up the ball at the moment. And, you know, two of Newcastle's goals on Saturday came from Son losing possession, his third, and then quick transitions. And you know, that's part of defending as well. And, you know, I do think taking Kulusevski out of the team, who's capable of holding up the ball, kind of occupying a whole flank when he's on it, has really made Spurs suffer up there, and it makes it much easier for the opponent to kind of turn over the ball and launch these quick transitions. The same is true of kind of Richarlison. He can provide a bit of hold-up play. I know he's been injured for more or less a month with a knee problem. So I think the defence is an issue, but I don't think it's the personnel in defence. I think it's the rest of the team. It's just kind of not functioning properly from a defensive sort of standpoint. And, you know, I do wonder I don't think Ange should start compromising on his principles. I think if you do that, you end up like Erik ten Hag's United. But I think what he could do is be a bit more pragmatic with his selections. You know, I wonder whether just sticking Højbjerg in at six, you know, would have made the team more solid on Saturday. And I think he's probably, I know Marcus is laughing because I don't like Højbjerg, and probably he's reluctant to do that because Højbjerg's got no kind of long-term future at Spurs. But I just don't think Bissouma, for example, is doing that job.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, at what point do we say with Bissouma, and we've always said that he was brilliant in that first couple of months of the season, but at what point do we start to think actually that was the asterisk, that actually he produced a kind of a golden period, but actually Bissouma's default is what he's delivering now and is what he delivered under Conte, for example. Because if you look at all the bulk of evidence with Bissouma, it is that those two or three months were the outlier, not what we've seen in the last couple of months, you know, and maybe he's just reverted to the norm, because it is true, and I agree with
But he was an outstanding box-to-box midfield player at Brighton, though. So it depends if you're looking at just his time at Spurs or his time in the Premier League as a whole.
Yeah, but it's been a long time now since he was playing like that for Brighton, you know, and how long do you wait? I mean, it's a question I don't think we were expecting to ask two or three months ago. But do Tottenham need to go and sign a central midfielder who can play in Bissouma's position in the summer? Because ultimately, we don't think maybe that Bissouma is good enough or conscientious enough or positionally aware enough to play in this, what is a very crucial position in Postecoglou's team, because it is true that it was the same against Fulham, and it was really noticeable against Fulham that every time Fulham played one or two passes through the Spurs press, suddenly there was an absolute gulf of space in central midfield. You know, you beat one or two players against Spurs, and basically you have the back line, you're in 1v1. You know, and that was exactly the same against Newcastle as well. And managers, I think, are now seeing this, that they know that Spurs' press is so gung-ho that if they get through it, then you basically have the whole pitch to yourselves, you know. And maybe Bissouma might be saying to himself, well, look, how on earth can I cover half a pitch on my own, you know? And he might think there's a problem here with the system. But ultimately, all we can say is he's not doing the job he needs to be doing in this team right now. That's the problem.
Yeah, I think Bissouma's got certain qualities, but I've gone from thinking Spurs most need a winger or a centre-forward to thinking what they need most in the summer is a kind of, I know it's easy to say this because and they're fabulous players, but, you know, a Rodri or a Declan Rice, you know, someone who can kind of dominate the middle of the park and screen the defence. Bissouma's not that guy. Højbjerg is probably the closest thing Spurs have to someone who's happy to do that, but he's not got a future under Ange. And we don't know what's happened to Skip. He's completely out of the picture. He can't get in the squad. He's obviously not kind of fancied. So, you know, it's a problem area.
Well, the two things I want to say about this, first of all, is, you know, primarily, I think, because of the system, we managed to make teams like Newcastle and Fulham and even Everton look really good. And that kind of frustrates me because they're not that good. But secondly, all right, if we are fragile at the back, and Tom makes the good point that it's always harem scarem and we've got to score more goals than the opposition, the trouble is just recently going forward, we have looked very, very ordinary as well. And whether you put that partly down to the fact that Maddison, like Bissouma, hasn't rediscovered the great early season form that made him so exciting. And also to me, the fact that we just are so overly intricate. Whenever we try and attack, it's a pass here, it's a pass there. For God's sake, sometimes just try and play a killer through ball. Have some shots, as we did, by the way, against Nottingham Forest the previous week and how that worked. And the other thing I have to say, and we refer to him every single week, and one week it's, oh yes, he's great value for 15 million quid. The next week, no, he's not. I'm sorry, but based on Saturday, Timo Werner is not good enough. Discuss, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny with Werner. I mean, it would be a different, as you said, it would just be a different conclusion based on pretty much every game. That the problem is he'll likely go and score in the next game or the game after that, and then suddenly we think, oh, hold on, he's good value at 50 million again. I don't think Saturday changes a great deal about Werner. I know he missed the two best chances Spurs had in the game in the first half, and that could have made a very, very different game, obviously, if he'd buried one or both of those. But, you know, the fact is, I still think he's going to give you a goal or assist every other game, pretty much. That's what he's averaging now. That's what he averaged in the Premier League at Chelsea. He's going to miss a lot of big chances. It's going to frustrate you, but he's going to play and do his bit in a system. He's going to be a kind of functional cog in the sort of Ange machine. And as long as he's not starting every single game next season and he's part of a kind of front five or six and probably, let's face it, an impact sub, then I still think it stands that he's decent value at 50 million. But yeah, it's kind of, we kind of had this chat about Johnson early in the season, didn't we? When he was kind of playing sort of 14, 15 games in a row and you're starting every time because there were so many injuries. And you were just thinking, I know there's a really good player in Brennan Johnson, but Spurs did not sign him to start kind of 14, 15 games in a row. The plan would have been to gently introduce him off the bench. And that's happened in the last few months and he's been a lot better. And it's kind of similar with Werner. I think if they signed him, they wouldn't be signing him to kind of be a regular every week from the left. They would be signing him to be a rotation option. So you kind of hope that the squad's at that point with him next year and not at the point where Ange needs to play him every single week.
I think I've always been slightly more sceptical about Werner on the kind of spectrum on this pod than maybe others. And I think that's mainly because I take Dan's point. If you look at the kind of assists and the goals record that he will probably have at the end of the season, you would say that his contribution overall will be you know, fairly decent and probably would look like good value at 15 million. The problem I have with Werner is I think what he kind of creates in the team and the crowd and the way Spurs play as a result of him being in that position, which I think you could have a debate to say that left wing is now the most important position in the modern game. Most of the best teams have their best players at left and right wing. Spurs don't at the moment. And the problem is with Werner is that so much of the game right now goes through him. You know, so much of the way Spurs play seems to go through him. Whereas in the first 3 or 4 months, it was going through Madison or it was going through Son. And everything was so much more crisp and precise. Whereas everything now seems to be about quick balls through over the top for Werner. And everyone's, you know, on tenterhooks about whether or not he may or may not finish a really good chance. And the kind of emotional and tactical energy that I think he saps from this team, I think isn't something that can be dismissed. It's not just about the kind of assists and goals, which, to be honest, you could put a lot of players and play them at left wing and Ange Postecoglou at Tottenham. They would get some decent results in terms of assists and goals. It's the kind of psychological and tactical elements that I think he dictates that actually need also to be considered. I don't doubt he's a good player, but the comparison with Johnson is not quite fair, I don't think, because Werner is 28 years old. Johnson is, what, 22, 23? And presumably Spurs spent the money on Johnson because they're hoping he's going to go to a level which is much, much higher than Werner could ever achieve. We know what Werner can achieve, and it is this constant kind of mediocrity. And Tottenham need to be, if they want to make the next step, they need not to be kind of chugging up their squad with more 6 out of 10s. They actually need to be saying every player we sign now needs to be a potential elite player. It needs to be someone who's going to take the squad to the next level, not to sign more and more of the guff that they've been trying to get rid of in the last few years. And I think there is a wider point here to be made about the kind of front third, and it goes back to what we're talking about, the defending, where I take your point, Marcus, about the kind of tippy-tappy sometimes, but I actually think that the more of Tottenham's problem is that sometimes they rush, you know, and that so much of their final third output with Johnson and Werner and even Sonny is a bit too trying to create the goal too fast, you know, and they're trying to beat someone and fire it across the box or something. And actually, if you look at the way City play and you look at the way Arsenal play, it's all about control. It's all about patience. It's all about waiting to create the quality of chance rather than just creating something out of nothing or whatever. And what you end up having is this pinball match where Spurs go forward, they try and create a chance, they lose it, they go back. And it doesn't, I almost feel sorry for the central midfielders because they must not know whether they're coming or going. You know, do they support this attack or do they go back and try and hold position for the defence? Ange has said a few times, I think we rushed our play in the final third. And it kind of feels like he was talking about kind of chances and finishing. But I also think he thinks it's also about the kind of the pace of Tottenham's play. That because they're trying to do everything so quickly, it means there's no control, there's no stability in the way they play. And I think that contributes to the defensive problems as well.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I'd say that there's two contrasts. There are periods when they are frenetic, you know, going for it too much. But then there are also times I feel when we're almost stationary. Everyone's static, and there's just too many touches. I mean, I don't know. I saw the stat at one stage in the game. I mean, Tottenham had so many more passes than Newcastle, but you know, 95% of them counted for absolutely nothing. But clearly, Newcastle is a place we don't like going to. We actually did better there on Saturday than last season, so it's a small step in the right direction. But the defeat, actually, and the subsequent match between Aston Villa and Arsenal has changed my mindset on what I kind of expect and want from the rest of the season to the degree... Well, first of all, let me check with you guys. You know, we're recording this on Monday afternoon. So yesterday, Dan, Tom, were you cheering for Arsenal or for Aston Villa? KP?
Well, I was at the game as press, so I wasn't cheering for anyone. I want to make that point very clear.
Silently cheering.
Now, look, I don't mind taking off my journalist hat. I try and keep it on and be a good professional, but I'll happily put on my Spurs fan hat and say that I actually found your tweet quite surprising. I think, as a Spurs fan, surely missing out on the top four for Arsenal not to win the league is a price any Spurs fan would happily pay. I mean, certainly thinking as a fan, I would happily pay that price and take fifth if it meant not having Arsenal as champions. Yeah, as a reporter, I was a very diligent neutral yesterday. I enjoyed the game. I thought Villa were fantastic. I mean, the contrast between the way they played against Spurs at home when it was kind of a similar position at halftime, you know, 0-0, and then Villa tried to step it up and step up the tempo at halftime and just got picked off. Against Arsenal, they stepped up the tempo and blew them away. You know, they were fantastic in the second half, and actually, I think there's a point to be made about Spurs there, which is that, you know, after that 4-0 drubbing at home to Spurs, I'm sure there were some Villa fans wondering if Emery should compromise on his principles, wondering if he should abandon the high line and stop playing out from the back and be a bit more pragmatic and all these type of things we're wondering about Ange now. And, you know, he stuck to his guns, Emery, and they played such a brave game at the Emirates yesterday. And I think that's what Spurs should do. And I think Spurs are going to get a similar result against either Liverpool, Arsenal or City. I haven't decided who yet, but I think they'll get a 2-0 against one of the top three, playing the way they want to play. And I think Villa are a good example of why managers shouldn't compromise after really, really difficult results.
But also, is there not a thing here where Spurs fans are less bothered about being in the Champions League than they have been before? I mean, I've never sensed a kind of a sense of feeling quite agnostic about being in the Champions League next season. And I don't know if that's because the Champions League looks like it's going to be quite crap next season because there are like 100 teams playing in various playoff rounds and no one understands the rules, or if it's because actually what Ange has kind of been wittering on about in press conferences about not caring about fourth is seeping through to the fan base.
I think definitely the latter. I think fans often take their lead from what the manager's saying, and I'm sure that's had a bit of an impact. Well, they'll be interested to hear from Marcus because he seems desperate to get in the Champions League.
Well, no, but I have changed my mind based on yesterday because, I forget the name. Somebody tweeted me back and quite rightly made the point that Spurs aren't ready for the Champions League and that actually the Europa League presents a very good opportunity to go deep and possibly win a trophy as long as we take it seriously, which I'm sure under Ange we would. And so, you know, I changed my mindset midway through. I was also really appreciating the way that Aston Villa were playing and thought, yeah, what's wrong with me? I mean, we get in the Champions League with Arsenal having become champions, and then we get knocked out in the group stage. What value is that? So, no, I've changed my mind. I do think that getting into the Europa League would not be a bad thing at all. And actually, going back to Timo Werner, by the way, I feel bad about criticising him because when I go to a game, one of the things I look forward to seeing is Werner sort of bobbing down the left. And I keep dreaming that he's going to find his goal-scoring touch and be a really good player. And actually, during a lengthy Europa League run, I think he's the sort of player that might do quite well for Spurs. But no, I've totally changed my mind. Of course, we can't have Arsenal winning the league if it means we get into the Champions League. But I don't think we are ready for that. And so I'm sanguine, particularly based on the results in Europe last week. And again, you guys are much better than me at this, but suddenly fifth place is no guarantee of Champions League football, is it?
It's looking now, I think, more like it's kind of 60%, I think, is the kind of like current computer odds. It will depend on the results this week. But a couple of weeks ago, it was looking much more sure, and now it's maybe a bit more in the balance. But I mean, I also think with the Europa League, Tottenham can win the Europa League. Like they should be, you know, at the start of the tournament, if you look at the odds or whatever, I think they'll be in the top sort of three or four teams to win the tournament. And you look at where Liverpool are now, for example.
What, 3-0 down? 3-0 down at home after their quarterfinal first leg.
If you look at the teams, what I mean is if you look at the teams who get to the kind of final eight or final four of the Europa League, there's no reason why Spurs can't win the tournament and get into the Champions League, win a trophy and have the kind of run that, for example, West Ham really enjoyed that became a historic moment last season in the Europa Conference League. And wouldn't all that be much, much more preferable than Spurs scraping through the group and going out in the last 16 to Bayern Munich? You know, I think basically Spurs fans have been in the Champions League. They know what it's like. And we've talked about this before. It's not 2008 anymore. Tottenham getting into the Champions League and playing Real Madrid is not the kind of incredible fantasy moment that it used to be. And actually, Tottenham have been there. They've tasted it. They've gone to the final. They know what it means. And actually, I think probably overall, everyone would just rather this team get sorted out, get ready to kind of challenge for the title and win a trophy next season, than just plodding through to the Champions League and being there next season. And also, one other thing, just one last point to make on this, is that Arsenal finished fifth that year, and we talked about it before and how good that probably was for them not to be in the Champions League too soon. If Spurs get there, and they might still, by the way, either through fifth or fourth, but if they did get there, I wonder if the expectations on Ange next season would just be a little bit 20% higher than maybe would be helpful for the team. You know, if they're in the Europa League, they finish fifth or whatever, then everyone will see third, second, fourth next season as another step forward. If they get into the Champions League, then maybe suddenly the expectation is we need to be challenging for the title. We need to be, you know, beating Bayern Munich in the last 16. And maybe that is a step too far for Spurs at this point. So it sounds a bit like, you know, trying to find positives out of failure. But I actually have always kind of felt that for Villa and Spurs, not getting in the top four is really not the end of the world.
Mm. Yeah, I think those are really good points. And I think it'll help us over the closing games of the season because there's a brutal run coming up, of course. Yeah, what, Chelsea away, Arsenal, Liverpool away, Manchester City. It's going to be bruising. Now, just before we go back to a conversation we had in our last pod, which produced some really thoughtful answers, and thanks to all of you who got in touch over this discussion about the increase in season ticket prices, the new breed of fan that Premier League clubs are looking for. The beacon of light over the course of the weekend was the Spurs women making it through to the FA Cup final for the very first time. They did it the hard way. They came from behind to beat Leicester by 2-1. They trailed for long periods of that match. And I was thinking, oh no, this FA Cup semi-final jinx is going to affect the women as well as the men. But they found a way deep into extra time, and they're going to play Manchester United in the final, who saw off Chelsea in the other semi. Dan, how important is this, apart from the fact that it's glorious, how important is it for the development of the club as a whole?
Yeah, I think it's massive. I think it's a really significant step and kind of speaks to the growth of the club in general over the last kind of 4 or 5 years, going from a semi-pro outfit to, you know, the team they are today, but also the kind of really good job that Robert Villaham's done this season. You know, he's really come transformed the style of play, got them playing this kind of progressive football that is obviously, you know, in line with the football the men's team are playing as well. And I think, you know, that's really encouraging that Spurs have kind of seemingly made this conscious decision to have a style of play throughout the whole club, you know, be it men, women, academy team. There's this through line of tactical approach. And I think, you know, the best clubs, you know, like, you know, Pep's historic Barcelona is the best example, kind of have this DNA and this way they want to play. And, you know, the women's side have embraced that and, you know, and done really, really well. So I think that's hugely encouraging. I guess there are people that, you know, if they win this trophy, might use it as a sort of stick to beat the men's team with and say, oh, you know, even the women have managed to get a trophy before the men's side. But actually, you know, the sort of people in charge of the club, you know, on the administration side, deserve credit for, you know, transforming the women's team, really, and kind of lining up the two camps, as I said, with this kind of connected style. Look, I was I didn't watch the game. I was at the Arsenal game, but I've seen the highlights, and yeah, it looked like a kind of really gutsy performance. I know you watched it, Marcus, so I'll be interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I watched it thinking, based on, you know, I'm not an expert, but I know we've beaten Leicester in the league and they've had one or two issues behind the scenes. So I rather thought that Spurs were going to win comfortably, and they began very brightly. Then they conceded a wonderful goal, actually, that Leicester scored. Left-footed shot that just flew into the roof of the net, and Spurs struggled thereafter. But you're absolutely right. They do play in the same way as the men. The passing out from the back, which was terrifying at times, just as it is actually when you're watching the men's team do it. Oh my goodness me, what is going on? And by the way they're trying to pass out against Newcastle at the back on Saturday, that was just awful. And we won't go back to it, but yeah, sometimes tweak it and just boot the ball 50 yards upfield. But they were doing that as well, and they kept believing. And then just when it looked as though it was going to go to penalties, marvellous Martha Thomas popped up with the winning header. And there was obviously a wonderful atmosphere inside the ground as well. Tom, I just, you know, I didn't think I'd get quite as pumped as I did by the end, but it's great to see.
Marcus, you are that guy in the crowd who, you know, shouts out, just clear it.
I am, but I'm not the only one.
It's great. I mean, they're still underdogs in the final, right? I mean, they lost to Man United 4-0, I think, in December. But you never know, you know, and I think Spurs haven't been traditionally among the kind of big contenders in women's football. And this could very much be a turning point for them if they can somehow win at Wembley. So I echo everything Dan said. It's kind of symptomatic of what feels like now a more kind of joined up club overall. You know, I think the kind of reaching for success just, you know, with one appointment or whatever, that kind of era now feels like it's gone and everything feels much more linked up now. And hopefully they can get the win that they deserve in the final.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned the passion of the crowd, which takes us back to that conversation we had the other day. And it really did prompt some fantastic response from a lot of you. So thank you very much. I think it's a really important conversation as well. We were discussing how Premier League clubs, not just Spurs, are looking for this new breed of fan that's going to come and experience the whole day, you know, take advantage of whatever's on offer at the club, be it climbing onto the stadium roof, doing a spot of go-karting, whatever, spending lots of money, in direct contrast to those who are in the pub until 3:15, go into the ground and then are back in the pub by 5:15. And, you know, I think we all agreed that you have got to maintain the heart of your football club. If you try and get rid of those diehard supporters, you are heading towards disaster. But Tom, you got involved in some very interesting conversations. What was the general feedback that you personally got after that?
Yeah, we got some really good comments on Twitter, some really interesting thoughts, I thought. You know, and it does show, I think, what we were saying, and I hope we kind of conveyed this in our discussion, that it's not a simple discussion. It's not a black and white thing, this. You know, it's always very difficult to characterise any fan base, and certainly it's very difficult to kind of characterise them on the basis of location. And it's very true that there are some Spurs fans who live, you know, in the local community who are probably far more fickle than some Tottenham fans who live the other side of the world. You know, these things don't always match up, right? But to read maybe some of the comments we got. I mean, Evan Carlson said, "I think it's a false choice to pit local fans against those who live overseas." And on that note, please stop referring to international fans as plastic, in inverted commas. I did say to Evan, I think that he's right. We shouldn't. I think Ange obviously objected to this, but I think we kind of referred to it initially, quoting Ange, and then maybe we kind of just continued with it a little bit too long. He said, "I can't speak for everyone, but I've loved Spurs since I was 7. Just because I left the country doesn't mean I love the club any less." He said, "I've been to the new stadium only once and the atmosphere was electric. My experience going to the old White Hart Lane was that it was also incredible on good days, but on the bad ones, ... We don't have that constant drone in the Bundesliga, so there's going to be highs and lows. There is an important conversation to be had about the future of the club, how it treats fans and the community it represents. But to say it's an either or between local and international fans does nothing to advance the discussion." I think that is a fair point, you know, that you can't say that there are, you know, some fans who live in London who probably drop into Spurs once or twice a season, and there are some fans who live the other side of the world who, for whatever reason, are there, but are, you know, Tottenham through and through. It's less about location, I think, really, but equally, I think it's difficult to convey, but if you've taken the decision to move to you know, America or whatever, I think you have to accept that the club you support is still where it is. You know, that is the kind of the sort of fundamental base of the club, and the club has to continue to serve the people who are around it and local to it. You know, and I think even though you can't necessarily characterise different fans in different ways, as Evan has said, I still think that the local community has to be prioritised. It's about the balance, you know. And to be fair to Spurs, you know, and I think we have to emphasise again, this isn't just a Tottenham thing. This is a Premier League thing. And in fact, it's a European football thing. It's not really just Spurs. And some might say that currently Tottenham have the balance about right. You know, the season tickets are going up, but they are still relatively affordable, just about. But they equally have a very modern, you know, stadium, which is serving the needs of hospitality and wealthy packages. The question here is about the direction of travel and where it ends up in 5, 10, 20, 30 years' time, you know. So, and I mean, you know, there were other comments, for example, Michael Sienko said, no way it works out well if you grow the fan base by multiplying the likes of that Korean woman that Marcus referenced, or us Americans, people who shout defense in unison and think it amounts to atmosphere. Once the locals are replaced and you don't hear their chants, I'm out. Not all tourists are plastic, but I mean, you know, we don't want to kind of get into the sort of slightly ugly debate about, you know, nationality and who deserves to be at the stadium, whatever. I personally think that, for example, the Korean section, who are incredibly supportive of Son and the team, bring something really nice, you know, to Spurs matches. But there is a more of a kind of thing here about what the club wants to be in terms of the future.
Yeah, I want to reiterate that I feel a great sense of pride when obvious fans who, you know, maybe who've never been before from whichever part of the world they have come from are there marveling at the stadium, hopefully enjoying the way the team is playing. Of course, there is a role for them and they should always be welcome. I mean, Dan, the key for me, though, is simply that you've got to respect and protect your diehard fans, those who've been coming for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. I mean, the whole conversation came about because of the fact that a senior concession will not be available after this season. And, you know, whatever the rights and wrongs of that, I hope the club is not that one-eyed and that desperate to make as much money as possible that they will happily turn their back on those core supporters. That would be madness, wouldn't it? I mean, it doesn't take a genius to surely to see that.
Yeah, so is it new concession season tickets won't be available from the season after next. But yeah, I take your point. I do think it's about balance. I think we did it in a lot of detail on the last podcast, and I kind of encourage people to listen to that if they haven't. You know, my view still is and remains that obviously a kind of new breed of fan, if you like, a fan who's more likely to spend the entire day at the stadium, take in the attraction, spend a lot of money on food and drink and merchandise, they're clearly important for the club. You know, they help the club to these record revenues, to passing $500 million for the first time in last year's accounts, and I'm sure that'll go up again for this season. You know, they help the club to kind of reach new heights, and if Spurs want to remain competitive in the Premier League, you know, that is something they need to do. But equally, I think there will be a hidden cost of pricing out and forgetting about, you know, the local fans who generate this atmosphere, if that becomes the case. You know, if clubs continue to drive up prices across the Premier League, if clubs continue to prioritise a kind of new breed of fan over a kind of traditional fan, then eventually, you know, they will pay a price. They will lose something kind of intangible, you know, related to their connection to the community, their connection to the local area, and, you know, I think in terms of kind of atmosphere and support as well. So it's about, as Tom said, kind of Spurs treading that fine line between sort of heart and soul and revenues. And you could make the case that, you know, that's exactly what they're trying to do at the moment.
Mm. And Tom said before we went on air that I had to read this particular tweet out. It came from Stephen. It says, I think it actually came from Tom Allnut himself. Superb exposition from Tom about the tension between the need for traditional fans and fans who actively generate income for the club. As a Spurs fan who's a Welsh rugby supporter, I have an all too clear idea of what happens when clubs, governing bodies and sports fail to generate income. So yeah, absolutely right. It is that balance that Dan is talking about. But thank you so much for all your interaction over that particular subject. And if there's anything that we say that you particularly like, or more likely in my case, particularly annoys you, do feel free to get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. Make this as interactive an experience as possible. So, weekend off guys, and then we begin the running. At this stage, I mean, Dan hates predictions, but at this point, having seen Aston Villa produce a masterclass at Arsenal, where are Spurs finishing this season? Danny boy?
Well, I've already made a prediction on this pod. I've said I think Spurs will beat one of the top three. So I guess I can carry on predicting. I mean, it looks more like fifth, doesn't it, at the moment? I think I've been steadfast all season that I think Spurs will get in the top four, but I was very impressed by Villa yesterday. I guess a big factor is still their European campaign. It looks like they're in a very good position in their Europa League quarterfinal against Lille. I expect they'll win that game. And then, you know, suddenly they've got a potential trophy on the horizon. So, I mean, who knows? Who knows? I guess for me, you know, on the one hand, there's now 2 weeks to work on the many, many things that went wrong against Newcastle. And you could sort of spin that as a positive, and perhaps it is a positive, you know, and you can really dig into Bissouma's positioning and, you know, what went wrong at the back and the intricacies.
Yeah, but Dan, can I just say that he also had a chance to do that after the Fulham game? I think it was a 2 week break then. And although they improved a little bit, it doesn't seem to have lasted for very long, does it?
Well, that's what I was going to come on to next, really, and say, but, you know, judging on what Anne just said, the last thing he wants is another break like this. You know, he wants games, he wants momentum. I think he feels the way that the side is going to improve is by kind of playing football and you know, getting more used to his principles and each other. So, yeah, it could work both ways. But I think there's no doubt Spurs will be bang up for that game. The atmosphere is going to be amazing, isn't it? It's going to be really tough for Arsenal, I think, whatever happens, just because of the, you know, the feeling inside the ground. I'm really, really looking forward to it. And yeah, as I said at the top of the show, it's kind of potentially an amazing opportunity now for Spurs to properly derail Arsenal's title push. And I know that we don't want to go back to the kind of bad old days of the 90s and early noughties, when Spurs' kind of best hope for the season was just to just be spoilers for Wenger's Arsenal. But, you know, it would kind of potentially cap the season quite nicely to kind of spoil it for them from a Spurs point of view, I think, particularly if Arsenal are kind of already out of the Champions League and that's their kind of final dance.
Tom, fourth, I was going to say, Tom, fourth, fifth, or bearing in mind your occasional bouts of pessimism, are you actually tipping Manchester United to retrieve a 10-point gap and nudge us down to sixth place or even Newcastle?
Weirdly, Arsenal play like three times now before Spurs play them. So, you know, if Spurs are playing them now, you know, that idea of continuing their kind of southern decline or whatever you want to call it, you know, would be right there. But I guess they're playing Wolves and Chelsea before they play Spurs. So they'll either be kind of back on track or they'll be basically out of it, you know. So it will be an interesting dynamic. And I don't know if the kind of 2 weeks off will help Tottenham. I always kind of think that sometimes in these situations, rhythm and kind of sharpness and being in that kind of heat of games is actually better than sort of having too long to kind of stew and think about it. And I know Ange has said a few times, doesn't he, that the kind of stop-start nature of the season has been just a bit odd, really, for the club and for the team. I think I've been pretty confident about Tottenham finishing fourth for a long time. I've always kind of thought they would just about get over the line ahead of Villa. But I have to say, I am starting to doubt a little bit just because of the way Villa have kind of come back. You know, it looked a week or two ago like they were really wobbling with a couple of injuries, suspensions. They obviously got hammered by Spurs. They didn't look like the Villa of old. But I guess the biggest problem Tottenham have now is not just the fact they have tough fixtures and Villa have a slightly easier run in now, but that Villa will take so much kind of momentum, I think, from that result, you know, from beating Arsenal. It's sort of perhaps their best performance and result of the season. So they're going to be, you know, really going for that kind of last few games. That said, I think it's going to be tight. You know, I think Spurs have those two plum games against Burnley and Sheffield United. They'll have to take 6 points from those. Chelsea are a mid-table team. They should beat them. Arsenal at home is a kind of a one-off game, which they'll be pumped for, as Dan said. They have a good record against City. My guess will be they'll have to take 6 from those two against Sheffield United and Burnley and maybe another four or five points from the other ones, which are tough games. Liverpool away as well. But by the time they play Liverpool away, Liverpool could be out of the title race. So I mean, there's a lot of kind of moving parts here. I don't think Tottenham are out of it by any stretch, but they have to recover, and they have to recover quickly.
Yeah, and I think actually the results at the weekend have just shown us that you're mad to try and predict what might happen. Who thought? Who in their darkest, deepest thoughts imagined Liverpool losing at home to Crystal Palace without scoring and Arsenal losing at home to Aston Villa without scoring? And for that matter, Spurs getting crushed 4-0 at Newcastle. Actually, some of us probably did think that was possible. But there we are. Okay, we've got a little opportunity to reset, refresh, and then get ready for the run-in. But Tom Allnut of The Times, thank you as always. Danny Boy, Dan Kilpatrick of The Standard, thank you very much. I'm Marcus Buckland. Come on, you Spurs.